This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Revenge, payback, getting even, settling the score, vengeance. Whatever we choose to call it, it's an emotion we're rarely proud to feel. Yet it's present with us more often than we might want to admit. There are small incidents. A car cuts in front of you on the highway. You blurt out an expletive and cut off the other driver in return. And then there are life's tougher situations. A criminal hurts or worse, kills someone you love. The pain and the anger come pouring in. You'll do all you can do to make sure that retribution is delivered. And the impulse for revenge plays out on bigger stages, too. Each attack in the Middle East, for example, seems to bring a response. President Bush vows to bring in Osama bin Laden, dead or alive. People claiming sexual abuse by Catholic clergy seek multi-million dollar settlements. In trade relations, one country might threaten to impose high tariffs on another that refuses to allow access to its market. Nearly 40 years after the Birmingham, Alabama church bombings that killed four young girls during the civil rights era, the last living primary suspect is on trial this very day. And then there are those who don't seek revenge. Why? Former South African President Nelson Mandela is celebrated for his lack of bitterness after more than 27 years in prison. This hour, where does the thirst for revenge come from? What's the relationship between revenge and forgiveness? When is revenge justice and when is it punishment? Can feelings of revenge be transformed? Give us a phone call. Our telephone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And we begin this hour with Laura Blumenfeld, a journalist and the author of the book Revenge, A Story of Hope. Laura Blumenfeld joins us from her office in New York, and welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Your story, your book actually started with a personal story 12 years ago. Tell us about the origins.
Well, I was a college student, and I got a phone call one evening from my father, who was in Jerusalem for a week. He was visiting there as a tourist. And he said to me, "Honey, you're going to hear something on the news, but don't worry, I'm okay." He was walking back to his hotel through the souvenir market in Jerusalem. It was a quiet time in Jerusalem, which is hard to imagine now. When a death gang backed by Syria decided they were going to shoot and kill foreign tourists, my father was one of those tourists. A gunman stepped out of an alley and raised a pistol to his head and fired a bullet. My father got lucky. He survived, although news reports at first said that he was killed. Other tourists, however, were killed.
The gunman was not so lucky.
That's right. The gunman had bad aim, thank goodness.
And he was eventually caught.
He was eventually caught, yes. I didn't know that at the time. I was just very, very angry. But worse than that, I was frightened because I thought of how these kinds of attacks didn't begin or end with my father. They were part of a mindset which said you can kill innocent people to make a political point. And that terrified me because nobody is safe in a world like that.
And that was the origin of your anger, your desire for revenge?
I was a college student. I didn't have an army. I couldn't really, go find it, track him down and kill him. I wrote a poem vowing vengeance. This hand will find you, I wrote. I am his daughter.
Then you went on to your career. You worked for the Washington Post, did a lot of things, but this was always in the back of your mind?
It was one of those grudges. We all have them. It kind of quietly informs your life. You think, wouldn't it be great one day to find that person who hurt you, that member of your family? I never thought I'd act out on a fantasy. It was a revenge fantasy.
Why did you decide to act out on it?
Well, I saw more and more examples around the world of revenge and how it created turmoil, whether it was covering Northern Ireland for the Washington Post or partisan payback in Congress, how the Republicans, Democrats go at each other, even in the playground, writing lifestyle stories. The payback between sixth graders was quite intense, and I felt like, I have these irrational thoughts, but so does half the world, and I wanted to break it down as a journalist and study it and also live through my own dark dream.
Well, first of all, tell us the part about finding out more about it. You traveled quite a bit.
I did. In America, when you say the word revenge, people get a little pinch between their brows and step back and say, "Oh, that's not me." The word itself is a taboo. So I decided to travel to revenge capitals, where revenge isn't a taboo. It's part of a time-honored tradition. I went to places like Albania, where there's so much revenge. They have a revenge rule book. It lies around people's homes like the phone book on top of a refrigerator that you look up the certain rule depending on.
So if so-and-so insulted my aunt, I can look it up and see what I'm supposed to do?
Pretty much. There are 168 different precepts for every type of insult and violence that would trigger revenge. And it's quite organized there. And I went to other places like Iran where even the criminal justice system understands that victims of crime don't really want revenge at some level, don't really want justice, rather. On some level, they really want revenge. So if your brother is killed in Iran, it's not up to the judge to decide whether the killer is executed or not. It's up to you. It's up to the family. And the killer has to beg for forgiveness, and you can say, no, I don't forgive you. And even more than that, in America, sometimes the families of crime victims can witness the execution. Mm-hmm. In Iran, they can actually pull the trigger as part of the firing squad. They can pull the chair out, you know, if the killer is standing under a hangman's noose.
And you went to other places, Sicily and various, mafia, we all hear about that. After studying this, did you understand the feeling any better?
Well, I understood that the need to get even is universal and that, you know, there in America, it's channeled in one way. In other countries, it's channeled in another way. But I think that there's no denying that darkness. You know, we're taught forgiveness is the way to go. But I think the true challenge is sometimes you can't forgive. And it's finding a way to channel that urge and satisfy the urge to get even in a positive way.
Then you went to the Middle East.
That's right. Then I took me about 6 months to work up enough nerve to actually find the man who shot my father. But I dug around in police files and in newspaper archives, and I came up with a list of 25 suspects. I didn't have any addresses. I didn't have phone numbers, but I had names. And I took the bus north of Jerusalem and got off halfway between Jerusalem and Ramallah and just began knocking on doors.
And eventually you found the family.
Eventually, I found the right door, and I found the family. That's right. They didn't know who I was. I introduced myself simply as Laura. I'm a journalist. I'm interested in revenge. I'm writing a book. And they started to describe how their son had shot an American tourist in the head. When I asked who, they just sort of shrugged and laughed and said, oh, some Jew. This was part of a public relations effort. We wanted people to look at us and at our cause. And this horrible feeling washed over me as I realized they were describing my father.
Hmm. And you could not talk at that point to the shooter because he was in jail.
That's right. That's what they told me, that he was one of the men who had been arrested as part of this string of killings and shootings.
Now, in a sense, that's justice. They found the man who committed the crime, and nobody disputes that he committed the crime, and he's serving a long sentence for what he did. We all, in a civilized society, one of the artifices we choose to believe is that we give the state the right to carry out revenge for us, and in this case, the state had done it for you. Did that satisfy you?
It didn't, and, you know, it doesn't in many societies, too. In Albania, they were telling me about how prison is beside the point. They just wait till the killers get out of jail and then they take care of it themselves, because justice often is not emotionally satisfying to the victims. And for me, prison was beside the point, at least the point I was trying to make, because what bothered me, again, my father lived, thank God, but what bothered me was his mindset. And I knew that whoever this person was who tried to kill my father, being in jail didn't make him sorry, it made him a hero. And it didn't make him ashamed, it made him proud. And that's what I was really after. I wanted to sort of reach inside of him and shake him up, shake up his soul and make him realize that he was wrong. His way going through the world was the wrong way.
Finally, his case comes up for a hearing in court, and you're there.
That's right. We managed to correspond secretly. His family smuggled letters sealed in tiny plastic capsules, which they spit out during visits to the prison. And we got to know each other, although, again, under this guise of me just being a journalist wanting to know him. He talked about the shooting with quite a bit of pride. He described firing on a, quote, chosen military target. Once he described my father as a crowded area, which, you know, brought up images of Timothy McVeigh describing children as collateral damage. It was a complete dehumanization of my father. But after a year of getting to know his family and getting to know him, we finally came face to face.
What happened?
Well, as I said, after spending a year getting to know revenge in all its colors and all its forms and learning about turn the other cheek and an eye for an eye, I decided that I was going to try a third way, and that third way is called transformation. And what transformation says is that revenge doesn't have to be about destroying your enemy. It can be about transforming him or yourself. And what I mean by that is if I really wanted to change this person, this symbol of evil and terrorism in the world, I would try something, some kind of radical act, something impossibly optimistic to transform him. And I decided to do that. I revealed my identity to him in a very dramatic way, which I won't ruin it for your listeners, but when he finally understood that I was the daughter of this man, it was a very sweet form of revenge. He was shocked and he was ashamed. You know, we had pulled this trigger. He just had completely denied my father's humanity. And suddenly he realized, oh, my God, this is the father of this woman who I've come to know and like. And he wrote me a letter. He said to me, you made me feel so stupid forever causing you any pain. Sorry. But much more important is he wrote my father a letter. Dear David, he said, my father's name, said 13 years have passed, and I know it's a little late to ask how are your injuries, but I want you to know that Laura was the mirror that made me see your face as a human person, deserved to be admired and respected, and sorry I missed her message from the beginning. And that for me was very satisfying. I was able to take that urge for revenge and use it as a tool for enlightenment and help end a cycle of revenge rather than continue it.
Ultimately, we can read his words and believe that he's transformed, but we can't know that.
That's right. We'll never know what lies in his heart. Although, a month ago, we went back to Jerusalem. I brought my father for the first time to meet his family. My father, who had been described with a shrug and a laugh as some Jew and a military target, came into their home in the middle of all this violence. There was an Israeli tank had fired on a Palestinian truck down the road, and there were Palestinian snipers all around us. And I brought my father in, and he was a human being to them for the first time. And he said publicly that he now understands violence is not the way. And he sort of said with a bit of a laugh, Laura did get revenge on me, but it was revenge in a positive way because I understand now. She taught me an important lesson.
What about...
Does he mean it? I just don't know. But he's willing to say it at a time when there's tremendous pressure not to break ranks with his people.
But what about the other side about it? What about you? Were you transformed?
Yeah, that is definitely the case. I mean, I went through a long process which took me around the world and, you know, made me realize that there is a way. I don't have to deny my desire for revenge. I don't think that works. I think turn the other cheek is a wonderful idea, but it doesn't quite fit with reality often. And I found that I could take that anger and put it toward constructive use.
Can you give us, you know, have the feelings that lurked in your mind all those years, have they gone away? How does it manifest itself?
How does it manifest itself today?
Yeah.
Now, I feel incredible hope, and that's why my book is called Revenge, and the subtitle is A Story of Hope, because there is no question, looking at the news every day in the Middle East, but also what our country has gone through this year with the attacks, that these are very, very dark times. But here is a story, and it's a true story. And it's a story about how if you can see people as individuals, violence will decline. And I think that's what we're struggling with. There are dark times, but there's this little glimmer of light. And let me tell you, this is a man, the man who shot my father, who is a hardcore ideologue, who's wrapped in so many layers of ideology, he couldn't possibly ever doubt what he had done until I tricked him into seeing me and by extension my father as a human being.
Laura Blumenfeld, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Laura Blumenfeld is a writer. Her book is titled Revenge, A Story of Hope. When we come back after a short break, we'll speak with two experts on revenge who have studied the emotion and the impulse and come to different conclusions about it. You can give us a telephone call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or you can send us an email, TOTN@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. This hour, we're discussing revenge, its effects, and its motivations. And let me introduce our guest, Frederick Luskin, Ph.D., a clinical science research associate at Stanford University's Center for Research in Disease Prevention. He's the author of Forgive for Good. And Frederick Luskin, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you very much.
Also joining us, Peter French, the Lincoln Chair in Ethics and Professor of Philosophy at Arizona State University in Tempe. He's the author of The Virtues of Vengeance, and he joins us from the studios of KJZZ in Arizona. Thanks and welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you.
Of course, you're invited to join our discussion. Give us a phone call at 800-989-TALK. That's 800-989-8255. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And both of you gentlemen were listening to our earlier conversation with Laura Blumenfeld about her book, Revenge, A Story of Hope. Frederick Luskin, let's begin with you. What did you think of it?
I read part of the book yesterday to prepare for this, and I was struck by the personal transformation she experienced more than anything else. That is something I see all the time, that the people I work with have a variety of hurts and injustices and traumas to deal with. But when they find a place in themselves that releases some of the anger or negativity, they feel hope. Mm-hmm. And that's how I heard part of what her message was.
And Professor Luskin, if you could help us out by backing off that mic just a little
bit.
We don't like to expose our sausage manufacturer here, but from time to time we have to. Peter French, I wanted to ask you the same question. What did you think of Laura Blumenfeld's story?
I thought there were a lot of points in it with which I could agree, and that she identified very important parts of the emotional and also somewhat the intellectual structure of vengeance, and also its moral elements. I'm particularly taken by her reiterating a number of times that the urge for revenge is biological, or at least it seems to come out of the very core of what it is to be a human being. And we have these attitudes that, that we can't easily put beside ourselves when we ourselves have been affronted or harmed or victimized, or when those we love or those with whom we have affectionate relationships are also victimized. I think these are things like resentment and indignation. And often those kind of things have been given a rather bad press, as she said. And I think they shouldn't be. I think they're very crucial to the very moral structure of our world. And without them, we'd probably let an awful lot of things slide.
Let's talk for a moment about some definitions, and I guess they're important. Is there a difference, for example, between revenge and justice or retribution? Let me throw that one in there as well. Peter French?
Well, I mean, again, if you think that retribution is the proper understanding of the notion of justice, then there's very little difference between revenge and justice, because, in the sense that they both are aimed toward retributive ends. I'm not claiming that all there is to say about justice can be said in terms of retribution, and therefore there may be more to be said there. But I think there's a great deal of similarity, and some people think of revenge as something like a wild justice or an attempt to bring justice to otherwise structurally unequal situations or places where the systems of justice that we've established have been ineffectual. And that's one of the things she mentioned as well, mm-hmm. I think.
Frederick Luskin, would you agree with those?
One of the things that always strikes me is how complex these questions and how multiple the answers are. I have spoken to people who have, say, each had the same awful experience, say each had a child murdered or each had a spouse be unfaithful to them. And each one of them has a different perspective of what justice would be. And so I'm always struck by how idiosyncratic it is. And it's very hard for me to come up with one precise accounting, which is what makes me uncomfortable with the harsher forms of justice, that they're often just driven by a personal experience, even though I will agree wholeheartedly that they appear universal in the human species.
Our telephone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address, totn@npr.org. Our first caller is Melinda, who's on the line with us from Seattle, Washington.
Good afternoon.
Afternoon.
I wanted to call in and just relay two things. First off, I'll just speak about my husband. He carried a grudge. He had something happen to him in college, and he's actually was born and raised in India, but just a small incident, a practical joke, and he carried this grudge, this resentment, for more than 10 years, and it took him 10 years to exact his revenge against the student. And when it happened, the other fellow didn't even know why my husband was doing this, but it just took on its own life. I mean, he became obsessed with trying to get revenge for what he saw as an injustice, and it was just horrible. It really consumed him. I mean, he would plot and think about this, and ultimately, like I said, the fellow who he, you know, sought revenge against didn't even know what he had done to deserve, you know, the hostility when it was actually carried out. I mean, it was just so insane.
And then, well, you know, we've all read that line about, you know, revenge is a dish best served cold. After all of those years, did your husband feel better when his revenge was served?
He claims he felt wonderful. He felt like it was the best thing ever, but it just, I thought it was so absolutely sad. Again, I think to carry that type of anger and rage inside is so absolutely unhealthy. And I'm on the totally opposite spectrum. I mean, I had a horrible crime committed against me and forgave, you know, the people who did it to me almost immediately, within a week or so of the, you know, of the crime. Just moved on. I just couldn't see, you know, seeking revenge. I guess I'm on a different end of it. But
And I think there's,
Frederick?
No, it's Peter.
Go ahead, Peter.
Yeah, I think there are a number of different things that come out from what Melinda says here, however. I mean, one clearly is that the danger of revenge and of harboring its emotions is that, you know, they can overwhelm and obsess one. And I think that's a serious problem. I think also, though, importantly, and she pointed out, the target of the revenge or the vengeance wasn't even aware of why it was happening. It seems to me that's not really bringing out any of the just sides of revenge at all. That's far from virtuous. I think communication is a crucial aspect of any act of punishment, whether it be revenge or whether it be performed by the state. Those are things I think we need to think about as conditions for appropriate revenge. And again, proportionality is probably another one, a very important one. You know, again, harboring it for so long, it was a minor thing on her account, and then working it out without even letting the target know the reasons for it seemed to me to be more about oneself than about achieving some sense of a moral outcome here.
Sure.
And on the other side, if I could just quickly, on the other side of forgiveness, immediate forgiveness seems to me to be not a very good thing to do, generally speaking, from a moral point of view. It may help the victim, but it doesn't do a whole lot for the situation, unless, of course, there's some other entity that's handling the matter other than the victim themselves. But I think it always worries me when people are too hasty in forgiving. It says something, I think, also about our concerns for morality being overwhelmed by our concern for our own emotional states.
And Fred,
let's
let Melinda get in here. She's one of the questions.
I mean, on the point of, like, his revenge, I won't harbor on that, but it was at least 10 times worse than the practical joke. In fact, I don't think that my husband even remembered the practical joke.
So it wasn't proportional.
Absolutely.
That's what I'm saying. If it's not proportional, I don't think it's justifiable.
And then in my case, I mean, it was a criminal act that was quite horrific and stuff. And when we ended up going to court, I mean, they were, you know, sentenced to a lifetime sentence. But I wasn't, it was very unfulfilling. And I felt very sad about the whole process. And I just think, I mean, not that it was enough that, I mean, one of the people apologized to me. And I know that doesn't sound like much, but that was more rewarding than hearing, you know, that they were sentenced to 15 years to life in prison. And I, you know, now they're spending this time in prison, and it's not rewarding. I feel very bad about the disruption of their lives and other people's lives. I think the whole thing is a horrible situation.
Mm-hmm. Well, Fred Luskin, you write a lot about how revenge, and particularly nurturing revenge, makes people feel.
Well, what I was going to say is I work in a medical school, and my interests are as much health-oriented, that during the entire time that her husband was nursing this grudge, he was exposing his body to stress chemicals and disruptions that in some ways may have also influenced his ability to think. That one of the problems with anger, if it's not expressed well or if it's not moderated, is that it changes certain chemistries that make clear thinking or creative thinking more difficult. The only other thing I want to comment upon is that I, too, caution against forgiving too quickly, even though I lead seminars and do research on the importance of forgiveness, and I'm wholeheartedly behind it. I would concur to the other guests that you want to be very cautious to forgive before you've had a chance to process certain aspects of the experience and before there is some social part of, or consensus of justice, that forgiveness is the inner experience, but it's best when it corresponds to an outer experience of social experience or justice.
Melinda, thanks very much for the call, and I hope things work out for everybody.
Thank you.
Okay. Let's go now to George, who's in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Yes, I was just fascinated by Laura Blumenfeld's comments. I think that perhaps her comments are more centered on a personal relationship with an offense that she has received rather than a situation of national survival, which might give it a different coloration.
Sure.
For example, if her father had been killed, she might have felt differently. As I understand it, her father is alive and doing quite well.
Yes.
The second point, I'd like your guest to comment on the very ancient Talmudic observation that he who is merciful to the cruel will be indifferent to the innocent. I thought that was a particularly interesting observation.
Peter French?
I wasn't terribly clear. He who is merciful to be cruel?
He who is merciful to the cruel.
To the cruel.
Will be indifferent to the innocent.
Yes, I think the point is very well taken. To come back to forgiveness here, and mercy and forgiveness are not exactly the same thing, obviously. One can show mercy to someone without forgiving them. One can forgive without showing mercy, I think, as well. Forgiveness has a great deal to do with one's inner feelings, one's own emotions, what one carries or doesn't carry within oneself, whereas mercy has to have some, I think, outward relationship to the victimizer or the offender. I think there is a difference. But I think mercy too quickly given and given to the cruel, I think shakes the foundations of morality. Either we believe that some things are wrong, and if they're done, that they need to be punished, and if they're not otherwise punished, then someone has to take responsibility for punishing them. Or we don't, and if we don't, well, then we don't have much of a moral system at all. So I agree with the notion that you expressed.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Fred Luskin, stipulating that you can find Talmudic or biblical imprecations for almost anything, eye for an eye or turn the other cheek, but get your comment on the listener's question.
The hardest thing is how do we keep ourselves safe? And I teach literally thousands of people who deal with the cruelty that other people impose upon them or just the vicissitudes of life. And how do we exist in a world that is very dangerous at times and with other people who are very, very harmful? And there is no one simple, easy answer. And To say that being merciful to the wicked, if that detracts from being compassionate to the weak, then it's probably not a good idea. But the question of forgiveness is, can you see people more in their complexity than just limiting them to the one action that you didn't like. And that is a real challenge. Like, no person is just the act of murder, and no person is just the act of any cruelty that they do. They're complex. And I like to instruct people to remember that, that not just to get so lost in the one quality that somebody did that you didn't like or that hurt you. And that makes it a richer, deeper question.
George? I guess George has left us. But in any case, thanks for the call. Let's go on to Cicely, who's on the line with us from Louisville, Kentucky.
Hi, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I'm calling in regards to this. I agree with the complexity of people. And my mother was murdered in 97 by a disgruntled employee. And for part of my family, revenge is how they got through it. I mean, they wanted revenge, and they wanted the death penalty. And they almost yearned for it, for a part of their forgiveness. Not forgiveness to her, but to get through it. Whereas I had a really hard time because I believed in the complexity of this woman, and I believe that although I didn't forgive immediately, I forgave within a year. Her actions, because I felt like she had never been loved in her life.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so there's the story that backs up what I'm about to say. When I think that revenge for some people is an innate reaction. I mean, I had that feeling like I wanted to get back at her for about a year, and it wasn't something I pondered on or thought of. But in order to get past it, I had to release it, and in order to release it, I had to forgive. And I think that it's a hand-in-hand emotion. You have to forgive to release the emotion of revenge. And then some people get so stuck on not being able to release that emotion that they just stay with the revenge part. And so that's my thoughts. And I wanted to know what you all thought about that, if you thought it was hand-in-hand, and if you don't learn how to do one, then you can't do the other.
Well, we'll probably have time to just hear from one of our guests. But Peter French, what about you?
Well, I disagree. I don't think forgiveness is necessary to work off one's revenge for various obvious reasons that if one is able to punish, or if the punishment is meted out in a way that one regards as just, one shouldn't continue to have these feelings of resentment and indignation over the crime or the offense that occurred. So I don't think I don't think they're necessarily linked. I think that's somewhat of a confusion. I do think that for some people, the only way they can ever get over certain emotions, perhaps because they have wedded themselves to them so obsessively, probably is to some act of forgiveness that they that they perform for themselves, but I just don't think that they're necessarily related.
Cicely, thanks very much for the call, and again, I hope things work out for everybody. I know it's hard.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. We're talking about the impulse for revenge when we've been hurt or insulted. Why do feelings of revenge tend to be perceived as negative and morally wrong? You can continue this conversation online. Go to npr.org, click on the discussion section, and scroll down to Talk of the Nation. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR stations. Contributors also include the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, Patricia and Emmanuel Papper for support of the NPR Fund for New Initiatives, helping to develop NPR's new programming and new media, the Wallace Reader's Digest Funds, seeking to enrich community life through support of education, the arts, and culture, and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, on the web at macfound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
In 1769, a new invention swept Europe.
The Turk was an instant success, and it was the talk of Vienna.
A Hungarian nobleman created the Turk, one of the best chess players ever.
The Turk very rarely lost, and that was a very key part of its appeal.
The Turk was ahead of its time. It was also a fraud. Hear the story today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Tomorrow, the Rolling Stones are heading out on tour, and so are a lot of other 60-year-olds, vacationers, volunteers, adventurers, people starting second or third careers, reinventing 60. It's not old anymore, and it's tomorrow's Talk of the Nation. Today, we're talking about how to understand feelings of revenge. Our guests are Frederick Luskin, Ph.D., a clinical science research associate at Stanford University's Center for Research and Disease Prevention. He's the author of Forgive for Good. And Peter French, the Lincoln Chair in Ethics and Professor of Philosophy at Arizona State University at Tempe. He's the author of The Virtues of Revenge. The Virtues of Vengeance. To join the conversation, give us a phone call at 800-989-TALK. That's 800-989-8255. He was about to sit down on a little vengeance on me for that. Our email address is totn@npr.org. We've been talking earlier in the program about people and revenge on a personal level. Joining us now is Michael Sala, a researcher in residence in the Center for Global Peace at American University. He's the author of The Hero's Journey Toward a Second American Century. Welcome to the program, Michael Sala.
Thank you.
Is revenge recognized as a valid concept in the international arena between nations?
Revenge, no. Defense, yes. If a state has been wronged by another state, then there is a valid procedure for states to be able to take actions to be able to address whatever has been violated. But only those acts that are done in terms of self-defense are accepted as a justifiable way of responding to attacks.
So even if a response to something might actually be revenge, nobody would ever call it that?
Well, they would frame it very differently just because of the institutional process. That's the difference between what happens at the individual level as opposed to what happens at the collective level or the national level, that there's an institutional process involved that's much more rigorous and elaborate. So it means that by the end of the day, even though you might have something which looks on the surface to be very similar to revenge, because it's gone through an institutional process, it means that it has a very different flavor to it and a different sort of legitimacy.
Could you give us a for instance?
Well, for instance, like what happened in terms of the U.S. response to the attack by al-Qaeda on the World Trade Centers. I mean, there you had a response that followed through a process that was consistent with the national law of the U.S., consistent with international laws at the U.N. So it meant that by the time the U.S. actually began strikes in Afghanistan, they had already gone through a very rigorous institutional process at the national and international levels, which gave legitimacy to the U.S. actions. Whereas if the U.S., for example, had responded immediately after the acts with massive retaliation in Afghanistan before going through a national process and an international process, there would have been a lot of criticism that this was nothing but just sheer vengeance. So what made the difference was that the U.S. actually took its time, went through the institutional process, and it got a lot of support for doing that.
Now, are there institutional structures that exist to handle some of these situations?
Oh, definitely, yes. The most well-known and elaborate is the UN Security Council, and it means that those acts by states which the Security Council deem as legitimate forms of defense would be things that could be accepted by the international community.
Mm-hmm. So at that point, legitimacy is the word that governments in search of either justice or revenge, you can describe it either way you want informally, legitimacy is what they're looking for.
Oh, definitely, yes. That's the key. If they have some kind of institutional process that's behind it, then they can say, well, our action was legitimate, it was justice, and it wasn't just sheer revenge. So there's in the international arena, there's an attempt to show that all their actions are based on legitimacy and an institutional process rather than pure acts of vengeance, which are not acceptable as a form of international behavior.
Michael Sala, thanks very much for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
Michael Sala, a researcher in residence in the Center for Global Peace at American University. He's the author of The Hero's Journey Toward a Second American Century, and he spoke to us by phone from his office here in Washington, D.C. Let's go back to the phones. Our telephone number, 800-989-8255. Our next caller is Dan, who joins us on the line from Louisville, Kentucky.
Yes, good afternoon, Neil.
Good afternoon.
I have to ask the question on the revenge issue. You have to go to whom forgiveness belongs to, especially in the face of the Holocaust, with the annihilation process still going on year after year, and the degradation of the Jewish character, even within the camps.
Mm-hmm.
How do you reconcile with forgiveness then, and as it's still happening, taking place? And it's open. The question's open to any of your guests.
Well, Frederick Luskin, he's not asking you the easy one, is he?
No, whenever anybody wants to really challenge forgiveness, they bring up the Holocaust. You know, forgiveness is a very complex response to almost intolerable suffering. And within that intolerable suffering, we have seen that some people can access parts of themselves that simply have a different response than a vengeance or angry response. And let me just give you a very short description of a research project we did. We brought Catholic and Protestant women to Stanford to go through a forgiveness experience. The women were all there because their sons had been murdered. And we brought them to Stanford together and had a forgiveness seminar. And we did it again with a whole host of people from all sorts of aspects of that conflict, both sides. And each person dug inside a little bit and asked themselves at some level, even though this awful thing has happened to me, what kind of life do I want to create for myself? And that is the question that forgiveness asks and try to answer. It doesn't necessarily change the event or the person, but it looks inside and says, I can suffer less.
But what about those who have died, all of the millions? I mean, they cannot look like periscopes from the grave and say, what about us? You know, you who are living, forgiving for us who are dead.
Peter French?
Neil or Dan, a couple of things that you raise, I think, are very important. One is, I think only victims can forgive. And if the victims are dead, then I don't think, you know, forgiveness can be had. Now, you know, living relatives can forgive for what they suffered, but they can't forgive for what occurred to their, you know, to the deceased. So in one sense, I think you're absolutely right. Secondly, I think there are some things which are simply morally unforgivable. And if we forgive them, then I think we make a major moral error. There's a marvelous little novelette by Simon Wiesenthal that many people are aware of, I'm sure, called The Sunflower. And in that story, you know, he's presented in the camps. He's called in by a Nazi soldier who wants to beg him for forgiveness, and you know, for all that he had done. Simon Wiesenthal can't give it to him. He refuses and lets him die. The soldier is dying at the time, and he wants to, you know, to leave the world forgiven, but Simon Wiesenthal can't forgive him. And the issue that the book raises is whether or not he even morally could do so, whether he had the authority to do so. I think the whole question of both revenge and of forgiveness rests on questions of authority, as well as questions of desert and questions of proportionality that we've talked about already.
Dan, good question. Thanks very much for the call. We appreciate
it. Let me speak. Yeah,
okay. We'd like to thank both of our guests as well. Frederick Luskin, PhD, thank you for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Frederick Luskin is Clinical Science Research Associate at Stanford University's Center for Research and Disease Prevention. His book is Forgive for Good, and he spoke to us from the Stanford University campus. Peter French, thanks to you. Peter French is the Lincoln Chair in Ethics and a Professor of Philosophy at Arizona State University in Tempe, Arizona. He's the author of The Virtues of Vengeance, and he spoke with us from the studios of member station KJZZ in Mesa, Arizona. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.